You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to We Are STS, and welcome to UCL. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. Now, we've known for a long time about climate change. For decades, it seems, scientists have been telling us that to survive, and let alone thrive in a world that's warming, we'll have to do something to somehow get all that extra carbon out of the system. But what to do? Today, I'm sitting down with two of our first-year students, Fatima and JJ, to talk about geoengineering and how that subject intersects with STS. We're going to focus on some of the work they've done in STS modules and how that fits in with their own thinking about possible paths forward. How does STS help? And how does being in our community help to charge up their own ambitions to do good in the world? And just because we couldn't resist, we also got to talking about their experiences as first-year students here at UCL. This was one of the most fun shows we've done in a long time. We've even snuck in a surprise in the second half of the show, just as our own little treat. So let's get on with the show. As usual, I start by asking our guests to introduce themselves.
Hi, Joe. I'm JJ. I'm a, I guess, mature student. I'm 23, first year doing sociology and politics of science.
Hi, Joe. My name is Fatima Ismail. I'm a first-year student as well, and I'm studying sociology and politics of science, and I'm also the first-year student rep here in STS.
Great. Fantastic. Well, welcome both of you to the podcast. I want to just start by just getting a sense of you and how you came to be here. So tell us, what brought you to STS, Fatima?
So for me, I actually moved from Ireland to the UK and my family's here as well. And the reason I decided to pick this course is kind of, I thought it was like a really nice mix between STEM subjects, but also the humanities side. And I think it just fits with like my background since I do like some youth activism in different topics as well. So this was like a blend of both of them, because in school, I really, really did focus on the science subjects, but I did like getting involved in my community. So this was kind of like the perfect mix of the two.
Brilliant. Thanks very much. Science and activism. I can tell where we're going to go today. Right. JJ, what brought you here?
Well, since I've been 18, I've been a professional poker player, but my interest was sort of more the sociology and politics bit of sociology and politics of science. However, since arriving here, you know, I'm really finding it fascinating thinking about science, you know, this word that we use. What does it mean? You know, what does it involve? And it's been such a enjoyable intellectual experience so far.
That's fantastic. Well, you jumped into this, the other question I was going to ask, which was about first impressions. So enjoyable. Hey, I really like the sound of that. So JJ, will you want to say a little bit more about that? What are your first impressions of the program?
Well, in terms of the program itself, in the first term, we studied history of science, philosophy of science, sociology of science, and the oceans, you know, so it's sort of covering a lot of ground, which means that between each class, you know, it's very unlikely that you're going to be studying the same thing, which is great because you don't get bored. But also, I can sort of start to see this web of connections forming around all these topics, and that's really satisfying as well.
Brilliant. Yeah, thanks very much. Fatima, what are your first impressions about the program?
I think honestly for me, I feel like literally from the first lecture, I was unlearning a lot of the things that I had learned in the past, whether it's a fact like about what science is and the people that were like involved in its like creation and how it all came about. I think that I had like a totally different idea of everything that we're learning. And now I'm like, oh my God, like this is all wrong. Like the systems that we had in school, if I'm being completely honest, like it's just showing one side of the story. And I feel like here in STS now, we're kind of seeing different sides of the same story. But I think that's really what makes everything complete, because you can't just go in life and just, you know, seeing it from one perspective. And I think STS is kind of offering that lens for us to view it from like a sociological lens or a philosophical lens, and even just like as a scientist, like what it's like to just look at the world, I think.
Mm-hmm. So some of our listeners are teachers, and I don't want them sitting back saying, oh my God, we're doing everything wrong. So would you unpack that a little bit? So when you said you felt like you're seeing something new and the past didn't seem to fit, what did you mean by that? Like, what's all wrong about the past education?
Yeah, for example, like one of the lessons that I was learning from the history of science module, and I guess how you can kind of contrast that from what we learned in school, is that I feel what I learned in school is that it tells you science is very much so like a westernized pursuit that it took place in Europe, that's all where you can, you know, see science, and kind of everywhere else in the world it was like a dark age. But what we learned here is that no, there was science happening in other places around the world, and there was connections between those sides. It's just that you don't hear very much so what was happening, for example, outside of Europe per se. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's, I think, what I mean by saying, you know, I'm unlearning a lot of the things that I had learned previously, simply because I came in thinking, oh yeah, you know, science, you know, originated here in Europe, but now I'm like, okay, it actually didn't. And I think for me, it makes it meaningful as well, because I'm from Sudan. So I'm even learning a bit more about like African history and also Asian history as well, because in my background, I've moved around quite a lot. So I'm just learning now, you know, and just seeing and challenging some of my own perceptions.
Like widening the perspective. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah.
Well, let's do this. What I wanted to do for the listeners was, when we were talking about the first year, you guys thought it would be kind of dull to talk about the year. And then we settled on the idea of talking about some of your own work. And I asked you to send us anything that you thought really excited you. So like, send me a paper that you did that really excited you. And you did, which is great. So what we're going to do for the next 10 minutes or so is we're going to talk about those papers. And what I really want to know is just what excited you. Can you say what did excite you and that sort of thing? So, right. Let me pick one of the papers that you've got, and you can hear the paper in here. So who wrote, which one of you wrote Epistemological Challenges in Geoengineering?
I did.
Fatima, great. So we're going to start with your paper. Yeah. Let me set this up, and then you can tell me if this intro is right or wrong. So my sense of the paper is it begins with a problem. And the problem is there's this project in the early 2010s where this guy says, I know how to deal with carbon capture. What we're going to do is we're going to use the oceans and we're going to use plankton, and I'm going to find a way to supercharge the plankton so that they grab a lot more carbon. And the way we're going to do this, we're going to do it on a massive scale. And we're going to do it out in the middle of the ocean. And there's plenty of people who say that's not really a good idea. And he said, well, I'm just going to go do it myself. And he finds a way to do it and dump something like 100 tons of iron sulfate in the water, and basically fertilizer for the microplankton, right? And so the idea is we're going to see if that supercharges the plankton and if it grabs carbon, and my idea is a great idea, right? So I've got that basically set up. Is that right?
Yeah, perfect.
Brilliant. Okay, so we've got this experiment. The guy goes out there and gives it a go, and maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work. And what you've done is you've said there are philosophical questions here, right?
Yeah, so basically how this kind of idea came to me was after a discussion that I had with Professor Jack Stilgo. And we were just discussing this case study, and I had simply just asked him the question is, do you think this experiment is scientific or pseudoscientific, which is just non-scientific? And he said to me that the answer is not so much so straightforward, because there are so many different factors that go into play with this one. So I kind of started investigating this topic a little bit more, and I could see exactly what he meant by that one, because Russ George decided to do this experiment in international waters as well, which is already like such a gray zone area of regulations. And also he didn't feel the need for scientific oversight or really consulting anyone in the scientific community. But also other factors that you can think about this was the fact that the Haiti community has been struggling with the salmon population, like the decrease in them. And they have been asking for help. And, you know, in general, like nothing really is happening around as well. And I'm kind of like trying to see, okay, like there's like a need of like urgency to really solve this problem. Does it justify this type of move? Like, is this something that we should kind of be doing more and more simply because nothing around is happening? Or is it like a person's responsibility to think about, you know, bigger issues that your experiment could potentially have on the oceans, which is what I was basically thinking about, because in this experiment, I could kind of see some problems of like induction and just really relying on just observations. And just because, you know, you see results in the lab thinking that you can like replicate them in the ocean. But in the ocean, there's so many other factors that you can't really test, I suppose, in a lab. So can you really go and do an experiment like that when you don't really know what you're going to see? Like, can you really justify that? And also the thing with this experiment is that after it happened, it also triggered like the creation of the London Convention, which like regulates pollution at sea and stuff like that. So you can see that before this experiment, nothing really was happening till someone did the crazy experiment, and then people had eyes on them as well. So that's kind of what I was trying to do with this paper. And I suppose I link this as well with the philosophy module as well, because I brought in the works of like Thomas Kuhn, Karl Popper, and, you know, his idea of falsification and all of that. So that's kind of where my paper was going. I could ramble on this for such a long time, to be honest.
That's fantastic. What I really like about it, and listeners, if you heard the transition, you got it, which was you started talking about ethics and responsible research. And that is something we're big on here in SDS. And then you turned in a way to talk about what I would just say are fundamental philosophical questions. Like, if this is an experiment, what kind of experiment is it? Or if you've done this thing once, if you put a bunch of fertilizer in the sea once, like, what kind of science is that? You know, no researcher would take a single example as a conclusive experiment. And what I really like is you take basic ideas in philosophy of science, first year, first term issues in philosophy of science, and you sit back and say, hang on a minute, he's not following the rules. He's not following the rules we all agree. You know, the rules that you have suffered over for a whole term trying to figure out. And here's this guy just saying, I dumped it in the ocean. Something happened. I'm a genius.
I just did it just like that, you know? And it was just like the scientific method that was, can you really call it a scientific method? I think would be kind of be like the next question, because I think he was selling carbon offset credits to international companies before seeing actual results. So that's just a whole nother layer to it, because now it's like, okay, is this an experiment? Are you really trying to fix a problem here, or are you just trying to make money?
Now you found a third job for a philosopher, right? One is to philosophize and think about it, think about the scientific method. The other one is to talk about ethics and responsibility. And the third one is to talk like that and talk about things like, well, hang on a minute. I mean, you claim all these things. It doesn't look like you're following the scientific method. And now it just looks like, you know, if this is on your advertising brochure, I don't think that's very good. So the idea of like philosophers as regulators or philosophers as people who hold other people to account. That's a great third job. And anyway, I'm sitting here thinking, this is first term stuff. It's fantastic. It's really great. And I also am delighted that when you mentioned one of the great philosophers of science, Thomas Kuhn, there was a siren going on outside. It was like the philosophy police coming in saying, I don't know if they were going, you must talk about Thomas Kuhn or you can't talk about, I'm not sure which do you think the police would be doing? Yes or no? Are you a fan of Kuhn or not?
I mean, like with Kuhn specifically, I think this week was like the first week that we properly started really talking about him. And I think his idea was really talking about like a paradigm shift, for example. So then my question would be, okay, is geoengineering, I suppose, like our paradigm shift now with us trying to tackle problems of climate change? Mm-hmm. Now seeing that we can see changes because of the climate happening all around us. So I think people start feeling like a sense of fear that they must do something really, really quickly. But with geoengineering is that you have to be extremely careful with it as well, because you can make changes on such a massive scale that the, I suppose, worry becomes that you can't reverse it then. And now you have a new problem that you have to deal with on top of climate change.
As if we don't have enough to worry about, right? Right. It's too hot. And then we do something. Oh, my God, it's too cold. Come on, folks, what were we doing? But again, what I really like about the work that you're writing is the idea that there is philosophy in here. And it's not just superficial philosophy. There are fundamental issues in philosophy of science. And ultimately, it begs the question, you know, anybody who asks, what good is philosophy? Why should I study it? The idea is actually there's real value here, not just spotting, you know, somebody going too far, but also asking those basic questions of, well, what do we think? Like, how many instances of a trial do we want before we say, yeah, it's enough. You know, we got it. We understand what's going on. But again, it's a really great start to the year, and it's a really exciting paper. So I did quite enjoy reading it.
Thank you.
Now, JJ, so your paper was called Imagining a Bio Blueprint for Circular Construction. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to try to summarize this and see how it goes. The basic idea you hooked onto, there's an idea in STS called social technical imaginaries. And the basic idea there is when we decide what we want, quite often it begins with what's in our imagination. So how we drive science is heavily dependent on what we kind of imagine we want. Right. That's the basic beginning. And you've got an example of basically back to the plankton out in the open ocean. And you've got a case where people are thinking about, like, what good is that stuff? Like, what can we do with it kind of beyond capturing carbon? And maybe, just maybe, we can bioengineer that stuff to do things like become the foundation for concrete. Or the foundation for other things, right? So the idea here is maybe, it's in the maybe, just maybe, that's the key idea. That people saying, well, what do we do with all that plankton? Maybe, just maybe, we could put it to work for lots of different things and for lots of different reasons. Now, did I get the gist of that?
Yeah, and the reason that I was excited to write about building with blue biomass, partly, is because it involves researchers from UCL. And it's essentially, it's a global network of people in the UK, Australia, Denmark, mainly those three. And it's a group of biotechnologists, architects, and sort of policy experts who are trying to further the cause of marine biotech as a solution for this huge problem, which is the carbon footprint of the construction industry. And the numbers blew my mind. You know, I think it's 40% of carbon emissions globally can be attributed to buildings. And it makes sense when you think about, you know, we're heating all these buildings and we're lighting and also building them and then destroying them and then building on top of them. Like, of course, all of these processes involve so many moments where carbon is emitted. So what building blue biomass and what marine biotechnology potentially offers in the form of things like microalgae, which is like single-celled seaweed, you can use their properties to create building materials that actually absorb carbon instead of releasing it.
What I really like about that is that, that back to the imagination, that people aren't actually out in the open ocean doing it. What they're doing is they're thinking about it and they're imagining what they could do with it. And this is where I think you very nicely bring in the sociology of science. So this idea of the social technical imaginaries. I mean, we've talked about it on the podcast before, and we'll definitely talk about it many other times. But that idea that, isn't it weird how when people set about redesigning the world, they begin with their imagination, right? And so you've got this example where people say, we have this problem that concrete is intense in terms of its carbon use. Maybe what we could do, there again, there's the imagination. Maybe what we could do is put the world to work in some other way. And you've got a gang of people who are thinking that way. And they're a bit entrepreneurial. They're a bit biotech-y. They're a bit ocean-y. And they're bringing together experts in all those areas and as a way to kind of rethink the problem of how do we get concrete. And again, what I like about that is that we could sit back and talk about, oh, it's great to be interdisciplinary and blah, blah, blah. But you've got a great example where people are really trying to push ahead.
Yeah. And they have a you can call it a social technical imaginary, but maybe just a vision, right? They have a vision of a future where these bioproducts are used and we have a net zero built environment. But actually, another point is that what is stopping these kind of ideas from growing? And the answer that I explore a little bit in the paper is the dominant socio-technical imaginary. There's a paper which I analyze within my paper, which describes that as a techno-market imaginary. And I mean, this couldn't be more relevant right now. I mean, we have this vision that is, I don't know if you could say it's accepted, but it forms the basis for how innovation works in the world, which is that the financial markets direct innovation in the right way because they're self-regulating. And it's this neo-liberalist idea connecting the environment and the economy as though the economy can sort of self-regulate our living environment. And if you asked individual people, you know, do you believe that that is true? I would be surprised if the majority of people said yes. But it's sort of an accepted paradigm, I suppose you could say, that, you know, if you're going to have an idea, a technological innovation, like creating, I don't know, concrete out of seaweed, I mean, come on, like, how are you going to make money out of that, man? Like, and what big conglomerate business is going to buy you up and subsume all your research and direct it towards their profit margins? And I mean, I don't want to get all Marxist on your listeners, but not that I'm, anyway.
But again, back to that basic idea, whether you call it an imaginary or a vision, it doesn't begin with actually delivering, right? It's got to begin with a dream of where we want things going. And that's the kernel of the idea, I think. And there's another idea that you presented in your analysis, which I thought was really sharp, which was you talk about top-down imaginaries and bottom-up imaginaries, basically asking who are the people imagining the thing that has cultural force. And you stand up for plurality. You basically say the one lesson we learn in history is when one vision or one imagination dominates in a community, and that single imagination tends to lead us down a narrowing path. And I really like that idea, because one of the things we push in STS, something that is we think of as a particular like flavor to the academic stuff we do in this department, is to really push pluralism as an idea, as a philosophical idea, as a historical idea, as a sociological idea. And I think you've already hoovered it up. What you probably had it before you came, but I'm taking credit for it. But the basic idea is that you're seeing the need to keep the pluralism there. Does that make sense?
Certainly. And what I unfortunately right now can't see is how a top-down enforced imaginary can really be overcome. The top-down approach came from this idea that I had, came from actually reading a critique of socio-technical imaginary research, that researchers like the people who first came up with this idea, Jasanoff and Kim, are assessing people's visions by looking at policies and analyses made by institutions. And then it got me thinking about, well, actually, these visions can be manifested from the top down. And groups like Building with Blue Biomass, their job is to introduce a new vision, and they're not at the top in the same sense, are they? Because they're either architects or university professors or whoever they are, they're not creating or leading policy decisions. So how do you combat a top-down approach? Well, you try and use a bottom-up approach. And I think actually we have a great tool in the modern day to spread a message from the bottom up, and that's social media. My kind of personal further thinking has led me down to think, hang on, why does this group not have a social media presence? It's all very well being leading biotechnologists, but it's like, if you're not capturing the imagination of real people, how are you going to change an industry or a group of industries like construction? I mean, come on, like, you're going to tell me that you're going to shut down the factory that my dad works for, like, so that you can make houses out of seaweed, you know?
With JJ's case today, I remember when myself and JJ were really talking about this, really was about the lack of social media presence. And I think like now one of the questions as well that I started to really think about is linking like academia with just normal people about these experiments and, you know, involve them. It's good and all to do all of this research, all of these exciting experiments, but like if no one really knows, you know, about the work that you're doing, it kind of makes you think, okay, is it just going to waste? And then you have people who have got like a massive social media presence that are doing just whatever they want, mm-hmm. which, you know, is kind of maybe even overshadowing mm-hmm. some of the smaller experiments that just do not have that support yet. One thing that you can definitely see now with people going into international waters simply because there's so many loopholes as well. And, you know, the regulations themselves not being too clear, maybe a little bit ambiguous even. The fact that now I think the ocean has kind of become a site of like experimentation. It feels like almost anyone can just go and do whatever they want. If they have some money, you can just take a ship and do something. So even with like the, you know, bottom up, top down approach, one of the things that you really have to think about is the success of these interventions that you have. For example, with JJ's case, I feel like with that one, it's kind of like a more long-term sustainable practice, but it really, really is going to take a long time. And, you know, in contrast with like my case study, which was such a fast experiment that was done out of nowhere. And when people heard about it, everyone was like, oh my God, what is this? And this showed like, you know, fast results, I guess you could say, but it wasn't very much so like a bottom-up approach. It was just he had the money from the local government and he was able to do it. And I think if you link this idea back to the international waters, it kind of makes you think that, okay, if I have a space to do something that I have an idea for, I can just go and do it, you know, it doesn't matter. I don't really need to be a scientist to do this as well, because Russ George was just an entrepreneur mm-hmm. and he was still able to go, you know, and do this experiment still.
Right, right. I mean, and I think one of the ideas that you bring in there is the tension between thinking about the oceans as nobody's space. So in, we've got the seagulls showing up because we're talking about the oceans. But the what I like about that is that you talk about the oceans being a place where it's nobody's space or everybody's space. And so the question of who has a stake in it, and you get a certain attitude of somebody saying, well, it's international waters, it's nobody's, I can do anything I want. Alternatively, there's plenty of people who watch and say, hey, hang on a minute, the oceans, they're everybody's. You can do nothing until everybody agrees. And I think there's a tension there in political philosophy. There's also a tension in scientists and the work of scientific activity. Antarctica is another example. The moon is another example. I mean, there's lots of these cases where it's an unexplored conversation, whether we want those places to be nobody's, where you can do anything you want, or everybody's, where we all have a stake in it. Well, let's do this. We talked about both of these papers. I want to talk more broadly about the program and some of the other thoughts you guys have might have brought today. But let's take a short break before we do that kind of thing. And so we'll go from there. Let's take a short break and we'll be back.
Are you thinking about UCL for your master's degree? The Department of Science and Technology Studies offers three choices, one in science, technology and society, one in history and philosophy of science, and one in science communication. These programs are designed for specialist training, preparation for PhD programs, and practical career development. To find out more, visit us online at ucl.ac.uk/STS.
Let's get back to my conversation with Fatima and JJ. We're talking about their ideas around climate action projects, from geoengineering to those houses made of seaweed. Oh, and there's that surprise that's going to sneak in too.
Well, welcome back from the break, everybody. So we've been talking about all kinds of other things. And when I started the show, I said we had an extra bonus surprise for you. And that is, this is the first We Are STS episode that's been recorded with a producer. I'm so excited. Brilliant. And now it's time to introduce her. So our producer is Capri.
Yeah, I'm Capri. I am a master's student of science, technology, and society here at UCL. And I really enjoyed this conversation because it got me thinking about what I want to do in my own dissertation, because I'm planning on focusing on solarpunk, which is a decentralized online movement trying to promote basically like sustainable approaches to living, like that people can integrate into their daily lives, like things like permaculture, guerrilla gardening. The term solarpunk is supposed to be a contrast to the cyberpunk aesthetic, because it's supposed to envision like a future powered by solar, by renewables, and it's not rejecting technology, it's incorporated into the vision. So I think it's a really interesting version of a socio-technical imaginary that I think, on one hand, it is hopeful. On the other, I guess I wonder how effective it actually is, and that's what I'm planning on investigating in my dissertation.
So how does that sound to you, JJ?
Oh, so fascinating. I mean, just so I understand a bit better, it's like a movement, an online sort of movement, because I first thought of the CryptoPunks, these NFT projects, because you said decentralized. So can you...
Yeah. I have not heard of the CryptoPunks. I try to avoid hearing about the crypto world at all. Mm-hmm. But yeah, solarpunk is, I'm not sure where it originated from, actually, but I first started hearing about it just like online from some kind of niche activist spaces. It seems to be a very aesthetic-inspired socio-technical imaginary. Like, they take a lot of inspiration from, like, Studio Ghibli movies as their aesthetic, so that's also a bit of why I'm skeptical about how successful it is. Like, are you just, you know, doodling Ghibli movies and saying you're doing activism? But, yeah, sorry.
So it's environmental activism, but done by individuals.
My sense has always been that it is people who want environmentalism, but they're not afraid to use technology to get there.
Yeah, and they do emphasize like a balance with technology, because like they've seen, for example, like the Green Revolution back in the 60s, where we were like, we're going to use fertilizers and we're going to revolutionize agriculture. And then they saw all of these negative effects of like having so many monocultures and how much damage like pesticides and monocultures have done to ecosystems. So like they do want to use technology to get there, but they want to take a, I think, more cautious approach.
Fatima, what are you thinking here? Where's the philosophy of science?
I think, honestly, this is really my first time hearing about this specific term. But
yeah, I think it's pretty niche.
Yeah, I think so.
More
I think
online
so, yeah, but when it comes to like politics and just like issues, once you hit the point where you feel that you can do nothing, I think that's when you give power to people to just keep doing whatever it is that they want. So I think, you know, if they're kind of creating a sort of community where maybe they're raising awareness or even taking action, they're kind of trying to find like that balance between technology but also coexisting with nature. You're almost like the same level, I suppose, that you must coexist with one another if you want to keep going, I suppose.
It's like you're defining punk there, I think, you know, like of all the movements that call themselves punk, it sounds like you're trying to capture like what is the essence of that notion. Capri, what do you think there? Does that match?
Yeah, I think that's very right. I think solarpunk intends to be very pluralistic and like rooted in the local conditions of wherever its very scattered online members are.
Brilliant, yeah. So folks, we've gone from three people talking to four in the room. So what I want to do is I want to move to slightly wider issues, and the three of you can jump in as we go, right? So you're here, students at university, you have a curriculum. So what's exciting you, not just about the degree, but what about being here at the university?
I think for me personally, what I'm trying to see is how I can even integrate some of these ideas into my own activism that I do. For example, one of the ideas that came was by a scholar named Christopher Stone, who talks about granting nature legal rights. You know, you're not just, as I was saying earlier, doing whatever it is that you want with nature, but you have stakeholders that can speak for nature. And I think it's such a complicated idea, to be honest, because it's like, okay, who are these people that will speak, you know, for nature? But for me, I think, you know, after I finish university, I really do want to go back to the sort of activism that I was doing. Since I started university, it's kind of taken a small bit of a break. It's still happening, but not as much.
I think of it more as recharging your batteries, that you're going to come out stronger and much tougher than you were before. Do you think I'm just lying, or do you think that
people don't know what's coming for them, honestly?
Brilliant. Well, JJ, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Fatima, you're demonstrating how STS and this kind of great approach to thinking can kind of buttress your capability to do something that you already know. So from my perspective, I came to university to get away from the career that I'm in. One of the best things for me about this sort of STS area is how open your pathways are. And I was just speaking yesterday to, I think, one third year and one second year student. One of them's going into sort of finance and the city. The other one's sort of going to China to do mechanical engineering, what was it, in the energy grid. You wouldn't think that those two individuals did the same undergraduate degree, but they did. And I think the freedom that you have to go down different paths, but also a specialized path, I think that's really nice. And I'm looking forward to hopefully working out what it is that I want to do.
So if you guys were to give some advice to teachers about sending students either in this direction or in any other direction, what advice would you have for your teachers?
Honestly, I think for me in STS, you really do learn about so many different topics. It can be economics, it can be sociology, it can be philosophy, all of that stuff. And, you know, it really gets you to look at the same thing from so many different perspectives. But then again, you know, once you're done with university, you can go in all of these different directions. My advice would kind of, you know, to tell the students that, okay, let's say, for example, you're a bit unsure if you want to go into politics or sociology, etc. You know, this course, I think, really gives you a flavor of all of these different disciplines. And if a student is unsure, I think really STS is such a great place to kind of dip your toe.
Mm-hmm. Great, thanks. I mean, one concern people have about a degree like this is it does expose you to a lot of different disciplines. But do you see any glue in the program? Anything that glues all that knowledge together?
Yeah, I think for me, really, once you start researching the topic itself, you can see like the connections that are formed between all of them. They're different pieces of the same puzzle and it all just fits in.
Mm-hmm.
So I think once you really view it from that way and talk to people as well in the department, you know, you can start to, I suppose, crystallize the vision.
Mm-hmm. I love it. We've moved from glue to crystals. I really like that. It's so much more fun. JJ, what do you think? I mean, are you seeing the glue or seeing the crystals?
Well, at this stage, yeah, I am. And just the fact that these essays that we spoke about earlier were based off the same criteria, but and yet we can sort of run off in these different directions and learn so much and then come back and actually notice the web that links them together in this kind of satisfying way. I keep using this word satisfying. It's satisfying. Things click.
I like to think of STS degrees is promoting kind of woods versus trees thinking, where we're trying to get you to focus on the woods as opposed to other programs, equally strong, equally interesting, but they tend to focus on the trees. And you definitely notice students sometimes flipping between the two, finding much more comfort in one than another. Yeah, Fatima, what would you like to say to that?
Yeah, sorry, I just also want to say another thing that I think STS, in comparison to maybe some other courses, it's a much smaller course. So I think within our course, I feel like I've gotten to know the students a bit more and even the professors as well. So some students, they can work fine in like, you know, a class of like 400 people. I think for me personally, while that might be okay, I do really value the sense of community that I get. So if you know a student that's, you know, really community oriented, likes to talk to people, get to know people and their ideas, I think this is like a really good space for it.
That's fantastic. Thanks for saying that. That's really brilliant. Capri, is there anything you want to add to the conversation?
Yeah, I think Fatima is right that community is a really nice aspect of academic life here, because I actually did my undergraduate in the Arts and Sciences department at UCL as well. And that was really interesting and lovely, but I was taking all of my classes, almost all of my classes, you know, in random departments, so you didn't really ever get to know the people very much. And if you want interdisciplinarity while also having like a coherent cohort, I think this is a really good option.
matching.
Brilliant. I definitely noticed that sometimes you get groups of students where they want to be on their own. They want to build their own world. They want to, they're very comfortable in large lecture halls. Then there's other students who want to be part of a community and want to that live off the energy of that community. And I love it, Fatima. I think you've got it exactly right. I think the energy in a department like this is fantastic. Right, before we're done, is there anything you guys wanted to say coming in here? Is there anything you wanted to say that you haven't said?
I think for me, genuinely, I'm going to say this because I come to the common room in STS pretty much every single day, and I have discussions with people like JJ and other people in the course, and I can really see like also another side of learning, which I think I'll call, I suppose, informal learning, and really how it fits into all of the academic writing that I'm doing. So with my topic, my case study that I was doing about geoengineering, I could really see how all of these, I suppose, were coming together and creating this piece that I have here. Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic to hear. I mean, we definitely see it in the coursework when students are working with other students to make their ideas better. But there's something else that, you know, that we're coming up to the fifth anniversary of the pandemic lockdown. And something that academics have been saying in the last 6 months is just how much more busy and integrated the campus is. And in fact, somebody was complaining that there was a lot of noise in the building. You know, there's a lot of noise. There's all these students around. And I said, well, yeah, isn't that great? You know, but anyway, JJ, is there anything you wanted to add before we're done?
Yeah, that's great. I was just thinking that when we first arrived on this course and I first had just introductory conversations with people, there was quite a lot of talk of like, people like, oh my God, what is this, like, of science? I thought I was just doing sociology, or, oh my God, what are they talking about, these lecturers? Like, I'm going to change course, da, da, da. I think I've noticed the opposite, like a kickback to that, where people have sat in these lectures and thought about these topics, and now you don't hear that anymore, actually. I don't hear that anymore. I don't hear people...
Yeah, can I add on to that? I actually, in my undergraduate, I took a couple of classes in STS, just kind of randomly. I was like, oh, philosophy of science, sure, that sounds interesting for one term, I could do that. And then, you know, I took another one, social sciences of inequality, like, oh, huh, there's a lot of inequality in the background of the history of science that nobody knows about, because, you know, we just think of science as so objective in mainstream society. And then I ended up here because these ideas just kind of grab hold of you. It's like the deeper you get into it, the more you start to understand how valuable it is to have this critical perspective from STS.
Yeah, well, I think there's two phenomena going on. One is that you're holding the subject constant whilst you're learning all the disciplinary approaches. So today it might be geography of science, tomorrow it might be anthropology of science, the next day it might be the finance of science, but it's always of science. So the focus is there. And then the thing that supercharges the overall study is science and technology is so important in shaping the modern world. And so you're looking at where the power is. That's exciting. So that if I were to pitch why of science, I would say that it's in a world of so much choice, it's nice to hold things constant and then develop a pivot. But then also science and technology, they are the most important things in the world right now, shaping things. And to be able to speak authoritatively about them is to be able to drive where we're going to go. And I think all three of you have a role to play in driving things in the future. Well, anyway, let's do this. Let's wrap up the conversation. I want to thank each of you very much for coming in, spending the time, and also for showing your research and talking about it, which is a thing that sometimes senior academics have a hard time doing. So well done, each of you. And also thank Capri for coming into the conversation rather spontaneously. We didn't plan that, folks, so that's fantastic. Anyway, thanks all three of you, and we'll see everybody in the future.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you guys so much.
What a great conversation. Big ideas, strong voices, STS put to work in the world, students on fire with energy and passion and ambition. If you know someone interested in the things we do here in STS, please just ask them to get in touch.
Maybe it's to explore innovation and diplomacy around the oceans. Maybe it's to study how technology shapes us or how we shape technology. Or maybe, just maybe, they're interested in the history of things like geoengineering and science diplomacy, or what happens to all those fish. These all fit under the umbrella of Science and Technology Studies, or STS. We are a thriving community here at UCL, and there's always room for more. Music today included two pieces, Rolinette 5 and Sweet of Vermouth, both by Kevin MacLeod, and both available from the website filmmusic.io. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Special thanks today goes to Capri Hoffman, one of our master students who produced the show and did all the engineering. She's our new secret weapon. If you want to find out more about the show, listen to past episodes, or give us some feedback, visit us online. Here's the address. It's ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast. Well, that's it for today. Thanks for listening. We'll have another episode ready soon. Until then, just remember, there's knowledge to be found just about everywhere, and that together, we are STS. Bye now.
You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address, ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast.